Good afternoon and welcome to another episode of Brand Money, brought to you by The Blake Project. Brand Money is dedicated to increasing knowledge about the brand licensing industry. We welcome brand owners, manufacturers, service providers, agencies, and organizational bodies active in the world of brands and brand licensing. We explore with our guests what compelled them to get into the field of brand licensing and ask them to showcase examples of successful product launches, weigh in on issues that confront the industry, and explore pitfalls that they've encountered. I'm so excited today to introduce Lisa Miriam. Lisa is a brand consultant who has made a career of helping companies build and manage brands. Her expertise includes brand strategy, brand naming, brand identity, brand launch, copywriting, and video production. Her clients include multinationals like ExxonMobil, Johnson & Johnson, and ADP. She's also worked with hundreds of small entrepreneurial firms and has tremendous experience with them and examples that I'm sure she's going to share with us today. Prior to starting Miriam Associates, Lisa was a director of brand strategy at McCann Erickson's Future Brand Consultancy, and there she worked with clients as diverse as McGraw-Hill, D&B, UPS, and ExxonMobil. Please welcome Lisa Miriam. Lisa, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
It's great to have you on the show.
I'm happy to be here.
Hey, Lisa, why don't we start off with just a little bit about your business? So would you give us just a thumbnail sketch of what you're doing at your company?
Most of what we do is helping companies identify what their brand is. A lot of companies think they know. They've defined their brand. They've created a brand positioning. But the brand really lives in the consumer's heart and mind. So we help them really understand what consumers say in their own words so that they really know what their brand is out in the real world as opposed to in the marketing department.
So if I probe on that a little bit, it's not really what the marketing department has written down, but it's really what's going on in the mind of the consumers that buy the products offered by the brand.
Exactly. And more now with social media, consumers are having more of a voice in the brand, and a lot of consumers experience the brand through other consumers as much as they do through whatever communications the company is putting out. So, yeah, it's very important to know what your brand is out on the street.
How many of the clients that you've spoken to or other companies that you're aware of actually appreciate what you've just said? How many are open to the idea that they need to understand from their consumer's perspective what their brand stands for as opposed to those who are kind of living more in the past?
You know, I would say that an awful lot of people still have the old-fashioned view of we're the marketing department and we define the brand. I had a blog entry recently that Chevrolet was trying to stamp out the word Chevy, and they felt like that brand name, the marketing department could determine what the brand was, but consumers call it Chevy, and they're not taking orders from the marketing department. So you have a huge company like GM not quite getting it. So I couldn't give you numbers of percentages of what companies get it and what companies don't, but, you know, it's a reality that will dawn on everybody eventually.
Yeah, those that are leaning in, as they say, will pick this up quickly and run with it. And those that don't are probably going to suffer more than they have in the past. Can you give us go ahead, tell me.
Yeah, with social media, this has always been the case. The brand has always lived with the consumer. But there was the illusion if you controlled media and you controlled the message that you were controlling the brand. Now, with media being increasingly fragmented and out of control, the reality of where the brand lives is becoming, you know, harder to ignore.
Take a second, if you would, and share with our listeners some of the brands you've worked with and how many, in your opinion, are actively using licensing to reach consumers.
One of the more interesting companies I've worked with in this regard has been Disney, and I think they're ranked as the number one licensed brand in the world. So they really set the standard. And work that I did with them was they license their brand to hundreds of companies. And one of the big companies they license their brand to is Feld Entertainment. Feld puts on all of their traveling shows like Disney on Ice. And Disney is very, very hands-on involved in controlling their brand image. And they had myself and a team go out to a show, and we interviewed customers as they were going in, or guests, as Disney likes to call them, as they were going into the show, at intermission, and then after the show, because Disney wanted to make sure that the show that Feld was delivering was delivering on the Disney promise, the Disney magic.
That's a terrific example of a really hands-on licensor brand owner making sure that their partner is delivering on the promise, as you say. You know, one of the things that I like to talk about is, you know, picking that best-in-class licensing partner. It's kind of gets back to the Jim Collins, you know, who's on the bus and who should be on the bus. And that also pertains to licensing partners. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah. And in this case, you know, Disney sells something very emotional, and us marketing types talk about brand promise and it becomes jargon. But it was really driven home. We did an interview with the mom who had a little girl dressed up as Cinderella, and we were talking to her, and she just about burst into tears. She said, "I am just so glad that Disney came here," because it was a small, very depressed town in Ohio. And she said, "I would never, never, ever be able to take my little girl to Disney World. This is as close as I could come." And this woman was about in tears. And that's, you know, licensing and marketing, all this business jargon. In this case, it really is touching someone's heart. And that little girl was just beaming in her little Cinderella outfit. I will never forget it.
What I think is so cool about that is that Disney, through brand licensing, allows mom to be the hero. I mean, how cool was that for mom to be able to bring her daughter to that show? And Disney did it through a partnership with Feld.
Exactly. And Feld was, you know, delivered on the promise. They had Cinderella there.
Yeah, that's
fantastic.
Little
girl got to meet Cinderella. And she did not have, you know, the money to fly to Florida or California or Paris or Tokyo to do it.
One of the things that I'd like to share with my clients is the idea that you can build brands through your licensing partners as much as you can through your own, you know, go-to-market strategy, maybe indigenously through manufacturing.
Yeah.
Do you have examples, other examples where that's been the case?
Yeah, I think when you're looking at brand, you're looking at how to deliver the brand experience, and the idea that you and your company are the best or even only way to do that is a very narrow point of view. In a lot of cases, a brand can extend farther and make more money and give that brand promise and experience to people only through licensing. You look at companies like Ralph Lauren and their Polo fragrance. Ralph Lauren does not make that fragrance. Lancome does. And then you take the case of Calvin Klein. You and I had been talking some time ago about it, that when they started licensing that brand back, I think it was in the mid-70s, like 1974 or something like that, they brought in $24,000. 10 years later, by 1984, it was $7.3 million. So a tremendous amount of money and tremendous amount of reach. And they had been licensing a number of products, but one of the brands or the products that they're very famous for are the Calvin Klein jeans. They almost bankrupted the company trying to manage manufacturing themselves. And in 1992, Calvin Klein had a friend, David Geffen, the record guy, who had to personally write a check and bail out the company because they were on the bridge of the verge of bankruptcy, trying to make those jeans. And he said to Calvin, "You stink at manufacturing." And so they ended up licensing the jeans manufacturing out. And when you say Calvin Klein, it's almost synonymous with jeans.
You know, that's a great example. We had on our show, the first show about 3 weeks ago, Nat Milburn, and Nat was talking about how Graco, the baby and parenting essentials brand, actually licenses out their cribs to a company, and how that was the first point in expecting parents, expecting moms, you know, engagement with the idea that she was going to be, or she and her husband or significant other were going to be parents. And they gave that special position to a licensing partner. And it's great to hear again, Calvin Klein did that, you know, back decades ago with their jeans, which, as you say, is synonymous with the brand. So it's really cool to see that brands can thrive, not only just do well, but thrive with licensing partners kind of at the helm.
Right. Well, in the case of Calvin Klein, though, it did go sour. They were able to build, the business from $50 million to $300 million, but they had real big brand problems because they picked the wrong partner.
Well, talk to us a little bit about that if you have a little bit of the history on that.
Yeah, they had licensed their underwear to Warnaco, mm-hmm. which makes Maidenform and things like that. And that worked out fine. But Warnaco wanted the jeans business, and he was not comfortable doing that because they didn't have experience in that area of manufacturing. I don't remember the company that they ended up licensing the jeans to, but in 1997, Warnaco bought that company. So they ended up getting the jeans anyway. And when Calvin Klein looked at the licensing agreement he had with that original company, it did not include a clause giving him power to veto that sale. So he ended up having his jeans license go to the people he didn't want to have it. So that was a big problem. And then they took over. They would change his designs, change the cuts, change the colors, change the styles to make it cheaper to manufacture. And then they also started selling them through Costco.
Mm.
And that was very detrimental to the brand image, and that showed in it was reflected literally in dollars and cents, because when Calvin Klein tried to sell his company, Gucci took a look at it and said, they're available at Costco. They are not a luxury brand. They're over-distributed. We're not buying them. So he was not able to sell his company because of it. So it had the intangible damage to the brand that really came down to dollars and cents. And they ended up in a bitter, bitter court battle over it.
Well, that's a great example of where things can go wrong. And, it really is contingent upon, or really the brand owner has to have, that last say on everything, I believe. And I think that's what you're kind of suggesting here as well, is that, if you're going to have a efficient, effective, thriving brand licensing program, you've got to have the right partners, and then you have to have the right contract.
Plus, you have to know what you're doing when you go in, which I think perhaps he didn't. I don't think he had a real grasp on his brand. And you look at someone like Ralph Lauren, who you might see is somewhat comparable, they really do understand their brand very well. And so they have a much more coherent strategy when it comes to licensing.
Lisa, what would you recommend to brand owners out there that have thought about extending their brand and haven't done so yet? What would you recommend as far as kind of the first steps in that process?
Research first and foremost. Just get out there and talk to consumers, and talk to consumers about how they define the brand, where they see the brand, what products they see as that brand applying to. There was another funny story of Harley Davidson did some licensing, and they licensed their brand to wine coolers, which really does not at all fit the image.
I don't think about wine coolers when I'm thinking about Harley Davidson and the
Well, and maybe driving and alcohol is not the best connection either, but somebody thought that was a great idea. I am sure if they did any research, that idea would have never actually hatched into a product. But understanding, first of all, how your brand is positioned, not in your marketing department and all of your creative briefs, but in the hearts and minds of your consumers, and then asking them where they think it applies. And it's whenever you talk to consumers, it's always insightful and surprising. You might think, gosh, I've got a lip gloss product, and maybe I should go to mascara, but people will say, oh, no, I expect you to be in purses. I'm like, really? Why?
Right, so you can learn a tremendous amount about your own brand just from that research, in addition to potentially growing it, correct?
Right, and your brand can go in some surprising places. You look at Caterpillar, for example, heavy equipment manufacturers. They do a pretty brisk business selling work boots. And if you think about it, it fits because it's equipment that guys and gals who are in the construction business use every day, and it needs to be durable, and it fits the Caterpillar image. And then you look at another company like John Deere. They've gone in another direction. They've done some fun things with their brand, giving it real personality. They've had who's the fellow who makes those monkeys? You know, this Julius the monkey, I think you've seen him all around. He's sort of a character.
Mm-hmm.
They had him design handbags where Julius the monkey is driving the John Deere tractor. So they've kind of taken their brand into more of a whimsical place than, you know, the heavy-duty, you can always depend on a cat sort of brand.
So do you think that was a good play for John Deere with Julius the monkey? And if so, why?
You know, it is because it brings the brand. The brand has, unlike Caterpillar, which sells heavy equipment, John Deere's available, has products that are available in a Home Depot. So having that appeal to the average consumer makes sense. It's not just a trade, you know, a business-to-business brand. So they, especially appealing to women, because it turns out that women are starting to buy a lot of lawn care equipment and things like that, or they at least have a voice in it. So, yeah, it does make sense. And, in fact, that handbag, it was a limited edition, I think. I'd have to check on it, but the one sold on eBay for almost $2,500.
Wow.
Yeah, so you can't argue with the money. Yeah, it was very sought after. I knew a woman who had one. I saw her on an elevator, and it took all I could do to not completely mug her and take her.
You know, Coca-Cola's done that somewhat as well, where they'll take the brand and they'll make it very, very high-end, take a tremendously attractive fashion brand and create a, you know, designed purse, you know, and sell it for, if not hundreds, thousands. So I think when there's opportunities like that, and they can really reinforce the brand's position, it can be fun for the brand to do that.
Right, and you can get some PR from it as well. You know, there's the licensing as a business, and then licensing as a PR stunt too. So,
as long as it all works for reinforcing the position, right?
Right, as long as you don't have wine coolers with guys in tattoos and chains.
Yeah, that's crazy. I could see beer, for sure, but
maybe
wine coolers, it's not working in my brain.
No.
So
definitely not.
Share with us, if you would, some of, some of the work that you've done, some of the clients that you've had, and what you did with them. You know, it'd be great to hear a couple of examples, maybe of names that we know and maybe a couple that we don't know, but, you know, that needed your help and how you were able to guide them along.
Well, I think the two I was mentioning before being Disney and Ralph Lauren were examples. My work, I don't do licensing programs, but I help companies understand their brand if they're going to go out and do licensing. So those would probably be the best known. There's also licensing that isn't so much brand licensing, but maybe product licensing. ExxonMobil licensed a lot of their chemicals. So they, in that case, they're licensing a product but not a brand. And then you have a case where BMW licenses their brand but not really for products. They make gift items that are sold in on their websites or in dealer showrooms, but it's not like you can go out and buy a BMW hoodie at Macy's. So there's kind of that dichotomy. So that, and then of course, you know, you have on the both ends of those spectrums, and then you have the people that like the Disneys or the Caterpillar that are really building that brand. Did a little work with Rubbermaid and Jeep, and some products. Jeep puts their brand on quite a few products, like coolers and radios and things like that as well.
So why do you think ExxonMobil licenses their products? What is the benefit there, in your opinion?
They license chemicals like polypropylene or xylene and things like that. They don't make the things that you make out of those chemicals.
So
for them, it's a way they sell the product and also some of the technology around manufacturing that product. So for them, it's a way not just to sell a commodity, but to, I don't want to say lock in because it sounds imprisoning, but to solidify a relationship as an ongoing supplier, as opposed to you going into market and saying, you know, what's the price of probably propylene today? You know, you license it and you work with Exxon Mobil in literally designing your plant to make whatever widget it is you're making with that material.
That's really brilliant. It seems to me that when they come up with these new products that they can be thinking ahead of time, and they probably already are, about how they're amortizing those costs, not over their own, not only across their own manufacturing, but across other businesses that they know are going to naturally take the product and introduce new products with it.
Right, and a lot of business-to-business licensing, you're selling the product, the stuff itself, but you're also selling the knowledge around how to use that stuff, the processes around it, what it's capable of, how to integrate it. There's another company, Inselectro, that makes electronic components in television or just any kind of screen, you know, on a computer screen or phone screen and that kind of thing. And like ExxonMobil, not a well-known name, but they aren't just selling the widget, they're selling all the knowledge about how to use that widget. And they literally will work in the office of their customer to design the end product because they've brought all of their knowledge about that product with it as well. So they're licensing the stuff, but also the brains behind the stuff.
So that's, I mean, what I call that in my term is like technology licensing or intellectual property licensing.
And it can get in trouble. It requires a lot of trust. You know, there's a lot of licensing problems. I work with companies in China. A lot of problems with licensing there.
Oh, yeah. China, that's interesting because, you know, there's so much prevalent abuse of brands in China. You know, I think for probably every product that's made and sold legally, there's probably one that's being, or more maybe, that are sold illegally. You know, what are your thoughts on China and how to work with them to kind of drive them in the right direction?
Well, one of the things to understand is they have a completely different understanding of laws and what's allowed. They wouldn't consider it abuse at all, for example. They have a completely different ethic. It's not that they don't have ethics, it's they have a very different ethic. And they have no tradition of intellectual property at all. And, in fact, it's a communist country that's evolving. Property is even something that's slightly not hasn't been in their mindset as business people for decades. So that's a big issue. And they... I was talking to someone from Procter & Gamble who went over and said, I know they're going to screw me. I just don't know how. And they were watching like hawks. And they found counterfeit Tide on the market that was absolutely perfect. They were putting holograms and threads in the packaging so that the packaging was almost like trying to counterfeit a dollar bill. They were so careful. They were watching like hawks. They couldn't figure who was so brilliant, who was able to duplicate this incredibly complex, security-conscious manufacturing and packaging operation. You know who was doing it? Their licensing partner.
I was going to say,
they were
their
running
partner.
A factory at night.
Wow.
It was in China, especially in the olden days, you had to choose. You had to be in a joint venture. You couldn't just open up a business there. And even though you could do that in some cases now, it's very difficult to go to that market without a partner. And when they caught the head of the factory doing this, he was not sheepish or embarrassed or sorry. The person said the guy was sorry he was caught. Period. That was it.
He was proud of what he was doing.
He did anything wrong? Pardon?
I said he was probably proud of what he was doing.
Yeah. And, you know, it was just, hey, it's not hurting anybody. They're only paying us to operate this factory during these hours. I should operate it other hours for my own purposes. And who's it hurting? And I am in the process of working on a book on branding in China because they really don't understand what a brand is. So it's hard for them even to wrap their heads around stealing a brand because they don't really understand brand as something of value to begin with. And you see her stories there. There's an Apple store that has opened.
Oh, yes.
Apple stores have opened up, and they're fairly close copies to Apple stores that are real. But and they have an Angry Birds park that is unlicensed over there as well. I'm sure there's other things that just haven't been found yet. But there's really no sense that you're doing anything wrong or that you're taking anything of value over there, because they just don't understand branding.
So we have to
educate
them.
I have a book
them.
Coming out on that issue, and you know, they when you talk to them, they say, I created a brand, but I still can't raise my prices. It's like, well, you haven't created a brand. You've got a name and a logo.
Right.
You don't have a brand.
Right. What is your book called? What's the name of it going to be?
I have no idea yet. I'm sure the publisher is going to come up with something. It's going to be in Chinese.
Oh, wow.
Right now, their working title is Brands That Work, because when you talk to people in China, my brand's not working.
Mm.
It's not doing anything for me. And so it's really to understand that a person isn't their name. Their name's an important part of who you are as a person, but there's everything else. So just having a brand name and a logo, without the everything else, you have nothing.
Interesting that you say that, because I get a lot of people, companies calling me and saying, you know, I really love this licensing thing. I want to do that for my brand. Then I talk a little bit about, well, let's talk about the brand hierarchy, you know, and, you know, awareness and, you know, preference and loyalty and insistence. And I said, let's start with awareness. Does anyone know your brand?
We love it ourselves. Yeah, there are a lot of things out there that are just names of products that aren't real brands. In fact, brands are relatively rare. I would say of most things sold on the planet, a small percentage of them are brands.
I agree. I'm curious about this whole China thing. I was in Hong Kong early January, so almost a year ago, and they had a big licensing conference there, and you know, they're promoting the idea of brand licensing being an important piece. Can brand licensing thrive in China, knowing what you know about the way that the culture thinks about brands?
It will thrive, but not as a set it and forget it sort of thing. You can't. There's not a sense. It's not that they're not trustworthy. I don't want to in any way suggest that Chinese people are not ethical. I really want to stress it's different ethics. And so you need to watch out. It's not that they're necessarily trying to cheat you. It's just that they're operating on a completely different system. So if you are licensing there, you absolutely need to be as diligent as possible. And like the Procter & Gamble executive, he knew he was going to get screwed. He knew it, and he was watching, and he got screwed anyway. So I wouldn't say don't do it. There's just too much opportunity and too much money. It's just going to be like Apple. There's going to be constant problems that you're going to have to go shut down Apple stores, and you might not be able to do it because the government won't see, you know, the government doesn't see that there is a theft of anything. They don't understand branding either. So you're going to have problems, but it's better to make money and have problems than to simply say, I'm not going to make money.
Right. Maybe over time they'll learn more and more. You know, the thinking I have is if you get your partners bought in enough, and hopefully they're not, you know, selling your product out the back door in the evening, then maybe they'll help police the real counterfeiters. And so maybe through time that will help bring China to really understand brands the way the Western world does.
Yes, it will take time. They certainly do learn fast. It's a culturally difficult thing for them to wrap their heads around a little bit, but there are definitely there's branding agencies cropping up, and some of them are very rudimentary and don't really get it, but it's not rocket science. So they certainly will start understanding it. In fact, it's a Chinese government policy that Chinese companies start creating brands. I have a blog entry up on it. I work with Kotler Marketing in China, and they say a lot of Chinese companies are building their brands in other places around the world, in third world countries, because coming into the United States and not having your brand savvy together is a very risky and expensive process. So you see Chinese brands cropping up in Africa, India, and other places as they start learning by doing. And at some point, yes, we will see big Chinese brands. I mean, people don't always know that Haier is a Chinese brand, for example.
Yeah, there's other examples like that where it was like Lenovo, I believe, who took the IBM brand, right?
Right. But you can't, the IBM brand had real stature. Lenovo is most definitely an also-ran. I don't think you could call Lenovo a particularly successful brand. Haier either. You know, they bought Maytag, so they're buying brands, but it will take them some time to really understand. Heck, American companies don't understand brands sometimes, so.
Exactly. We talked about at the beginning of the show. So I'm curious, and I'm sure the listeners are, do you know what happened with P&G and their licensing partner? How did they resolve that?
Well, he was terminated instantly. I don't know that there were criminal charges filed, but they continue to make and manufacture Tide's a big brand in China. It's a luxury brand in China. So they've continued. But the gentleman who was doing the late-at-night backdoor dealing is no longer with the company, and I don't know if he's in jail or not, whether they even wanted to go that way with him. But, you know, sometimes it takes some finesse in dealing with different cultures and different countries and different laws, and it might be satisfying to throw someone in jail from a moral sense, but from a practical business sense, sometimes got to just let things go.
I agree, and I talk about Procter & Gamble being best in class in so many ways, and brand licensing is certainly one of them. So I'm sure their agreement had everything in it to make sure that they could protect themselves. And I would bet that, you know, there was more of just let's stop this thing from going on.
Right.
One of the things that I've heard big brand owners do is when they find, somebody is breaking their agreement, then there's a penalty piece in, and if they don't have any agreement at all, they just find that somebody is actually using their brand, then it's like, okay, let me just make you aware that what you're doing is not legal, and let's find a financial way to make you legal.
Yeah, what's funny about the P&G case was that it didn't really hurt the brand experience because he was actually making real Tide in real Tide boxes.
So as far as the Chinese were concerned, it was
real Tide and real Tide boxes. It was just going not to the sale. The money from the sale wasn't going to P&G. So, you know, I think it's more damaging to the brand when you have like a Chanel purse made out of plastic being sold on a street corner, where it's most definitely not Chanel, It's hurting the Chanel brand. Whereas in the case with P&G, they caught it early. It was a real product, so it wasn't like people were getting substandard product or even dangerous product under the Tide name, which would have been really bad.
So in the big scheme of things, you know, it was really infinitesimally small compared to what could have happened to the brand, I would think.
Right, and they were very diligent. They were watching. They did everything they could. They couldn't prevent it, but they certainly, if they hadn't been diligent, who knows what could happen, you know. So you have to build that into your planning. And I would say, you know, I don't want to pick on the Chinese. You certainly have American companies like Warnaco with Calvin Klein. They started using substandard fabrics. They were, changing the way it was sewn. They were selling Calvin Klein jeans to Costco that were most definitely not Calvin Klein quality jeans. So here you have a big American publicly traded company, you know, cutting corners, and they were able to keep the license, but they were found guilty of changing the designs, unauthorized changes to the designs, and unauthorized distribution. So, even big American publicly traded companies, it's not a matter of even a trust, because in some cases, yes, somebody is doing something slippery, But a lot of cases, it's just miscommunication or misunderstanding. Or, you know, Warnaco was frustrated because the department store channel was in steep decline, and they were trying to work with Calvin Klein to say, hey, you know, we got to fill the gap. Where are we going to distribute these jeans if we don't have them in department stores? You know, so you have a legitimate question. They solved it in perhaps a less than ideal and less upfront way, but certainly a question like that, questions like that come up about distribution, about manufacturing difficulties or cost issues, and you just, as the brand owner, you have to be up to your elbows in it, whether it's China or anyone that you're dealing with.
The whole issue of channels and miscommunication, I think that's really a really prevalent point that has to be raised. And my sense is, in knowing Costco, you know, they talk about the, you know, whole treasure hunt. In their opinion, they're probably saying, look, you know, you can get best-in-class brands here. We just don't charge as much. And, of course, that's a question of perception as well as whether or not it's hurting the brand. And I'm guessing if they had talked a little bit more, that probably would have been avoided.
Right.
You and I met about a year ago around another couple of well-known companies and some miscommunication. Share with us what that was about.
Yeah, that was the Starbucks and Kraft licensing deal. When you buy a Starbucks coffee in the grocery store, it's Kraft coffee. It's not Starbucks. It's a licensed product. And you and I had talked, I interviewed you for the blog entry because the two companies were locked in an ugly lawsuit that Starbucks felt like they had lost control of their brand, that Kraft was marketing it in ways that were destroying brand equity, and they wanted out of that license. And Kraft said, you know, we made you. You owe us a ton of money because... we were talking about, what does licensing do to your brand? It brings it places where your company can't take it. And as far as getting Starbucks in grocery stores, there is no better company on the planet than Kraft. They have so many feet on the street, they can get it in every shelf in every grocery store. And Starbucks, there's just no way that they could hire and train and compensate that kind of a sales force. So Kraft was bringing them distribution in that licensing agreement.
If I recall, Kraft said that they had a perpetual license, which I think we talked about that a little bit.
You were making the point that they really didn't have a very clear deal. You know, it's important to build the exit into the entrance, and that's what they were missing. The lawsuit has been settled, and the upshot of it is that Kraft will no longer, I believe this is the last year that Kraft will be marketing Starbucks. Starbucks is now at the cost of, they're going to lose a ton of distribution. They're taking a small company called Acosta that's going to handle the retail selling. There's no way Acosta can match the reach of Kraft. But maybe they want smaller distribution. And Kraft, on the other hand, there's a lot of coffee brands out there that are premium coffee brands that Kraft can make. You know, Kraft can take any brand and make it. They just have that kind of power. They're going to be working with Gavalia in the future.
Wow.
And, yeah.
What is that going to mean for Starbucks in the grocery store?
You might not find it. You might not find it. You might have to go to a Starbucks, which, you know, thankfully there are a lot of Starbucks stores, but quite likely... If I was to put a bet on it, Kraft knows how to earn shelf space. And in the grocery store or convenience store or drugstore or mass merchandising store, shelf space is the battle. And Kraft is the best possible partner to win that battle. So Kraft will say, hey, you know, I know you're stocking Starbucks. We have this better brand. Try this one. Here's the deal. They literally have the money to buy the space. There's no way Acosta can fight that. So Starbucks may have won a battle saying, oh, gosh, we have quote-unquote control now. But they're going to control a very much smaller piece of business, whereas Kraft doesn't really lose.
No. If I were Starbucks, I would have worked my tail off to find a way to make the deal that we had with Kraft work. Because as you say, Kraft can build another brand and the same way that they built the Starbucks brand. And now Starbucks is going to have to compete against that other brand with a lot smaller workforce, a lot smaller organization. And if I had to bet, I would be betting on Kraft and grocery with a coffee brand.
Exactly. Well, you know, maybe the Starbucks stockholders are happier with a much smaller revenue pile. That's essentially, you know, Starbucks won the court case because they got out of the deal, but they lost.
You know,
they won out of the deal, but they got out of a great deal, so they lost.
Well, we talk about brands before revenue, and maybe that's what Starbucks was concerned about. Maybe they didn't feel like the experience was replicating what you could get when you went into a Starbucks. So in that case, maybe it was more beneficial for them to exit this and not have to concern themselves about the brand being diminished by the experience. But you know, I'm curious what you think, but in my opinion, I would rather have worked with Kraft to create the experience than to lose them as a licensing partner.
Kraft is a tremendous brand-building machine. They understand brand probably better than Starbucks. So if Starbucks said, hey, you know, these are my three issues. We got to work on these. I can't imagine they couldn't resolve 80%. And you know, to have the brand, I can't imagine what damage Kraft could do to that brand. But given the massive reach and the massive amount of money that you're talking about, if you could get 90% of your problem solved, work on the rest of it over time. But like you said, I agree that they should have done something to keep that relationship in place. And now that it's broken, there's no real alternative for Starbucks. It's broken.
The thing that I like about that, and what I suggest, I'm curious what your thoughts are, when brand owners want to extend their brands, who better than to partner with than a current brand owner who understands how to build brands and knowing that if they're building and shaping their own brands, they're going to take care of yours. What are your thoughts about that, Lisa?
Well, I think it depends on the brand, too. There's a famous story of Celestial Seasonings, the tea. That they sold that brand. It was kind of a hippie brand, and you know, I think it was in Boulder, Colorado, or someplace like that. Kind of long-haired Birkenstock people running that brand, and they ended up selling it to Quaker in Chicago, where you know that Midwestern mentality and very, very, very corporate. And it was a bad fit, and you know, it almost killed the brand. Similar thing happened with the Snapple. You know, it was kind of an odd little brand, and it got corporatized wrongly. So corporations aren't necessarily great brand builders. They can suck the personality out of a brand faster than almost anything. So it goes back to that original point. You really need to be on the same page in terms of what the brand really means, or you're just going to run into trouble, even if you're working with a brilliant brand builder.
With that in mind, talk a little bit about what's next at Merriam & Associates and how you know, people can work with you, how companies can work with you to really understand how to build what brands really mean.
Yeah, you had mentioned when introducing me the brand video part of thing, that a lot of the work I do is video market research, going out into the marketplace and talking to consumers where they interact with the brand. It's catching people in a department store or coming out of a department store or catching them on a sports field. We did a project for brides, catching brides when they're shopping for wedding dresses, about their wedding planning. So a lot of that work is getting off the cuff, straight from the heart, talking about the brand in context work, which is a fascinating way to do market research. You really get out behind the glass of the focus group and out into the real world. So doing quite a bit of that. And then I had mentioned the work in China. And also we had talked earlier about social media. A lot of companies don't quite know how to, I hate to use the word control, their brand in social media. It was even just as recently as last year that the McDonald's corporate LinkedIn page was made by some random menu designer who just, you know, said, hey, we need a LinkedIn page, and made it.
Yikes.
And literally, if you looked at McDonald's and their social media presence, they had a gazillion different logos, no real branded language. There's not any official, here's how we talk about McDonald's. Everybody just kind of made it up on the fly. So I think it's important for companies, working with companies, to say, you need to put your brand out there and give consumers the tools. There used to be, and in fact there still is in many companies, this idea of a brand cop who controls how a logo is to be used. You know, you can't put it on a photograph. It has to be on a silver background. You can't put it on a red background. You can't stretch it. You can't. Trying to control the brand. And in some companies, you have to go, in order to get and use the brand's official logo, you have to register on their website to get it. It's an incredibly naive approach, because who's going to do that? They're just going to Google the logo and pick whatever logo they want, and it's probably the wrong one. It behooves you as the owner, quote-unquote, of the brand assets to put the real brand assets out there and enable the consumer, give them all the tools they need to use the brand properly. You certainly can't enforce it, and when doing that, you're going to actually put the brand in the hands of people who will abuse it as well, but you can't stop that anyway. So you might as well give the brand fans what they need to convey your brand accurately, realizing that non-fans are not going to, you know, you're never going to stop them anyway. In fact, I have a blog post on BP where I covered their logo in oil. You know, you can't stop that. It's going to happen. But at least they use the real BP logo.
Exactly.
So helping companies get their brands socially ready and socially enabled and socially available. Because there are a lot of people who just create brand fan sites. You know, you want to if you've got fanatics like that, you want to feed them.
Well, these are great, great insights that you've shared with the audience. So I'm so pleased that you were on the show today. Can you share with the listeners how they would get a hold of you? How do they connect with you?
Best place is on my website, which is www.merriam, like the dictionary, with M-E-R-R-I-A-M, another M, associates.com. And all my contact information is there as well. And I have to say, the cobbler has no shoes. I do a lot of work in social media for my customers, my clients. I might have put up a Facebook for Merriam Associates, but if I did, I never did anything else with it.
So maybe one of your clients can help you get that done as well, together.
One of these days. I also have a Twitter feed, and I'm on LinkedIn.
Terrific, terrific.
Those I use. I haven't done a Facebook corporate presence yet. I mean, it might be there, but I don't think I've done anything with it.
Give you some time, right? Well, thank you so much for being on the show today.
All right. Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Well, that concludes another episode of Brand Money, and we're so thrilled with having Lisa on the show today. For those who are looking to build their brands, they should check out Lisa Merriam. And for those who are looking for brand licensing tools, check out brandlicensingexpert.com. Thanks again. Have a great afternoon.